eat.
Oh, so good.
Drink. Talk. Rick Redding and Steve Coombs serve up savory conversations about Louisville's world-famous restaurant food and drink scene. The wine is uncorked, the bourbon neat, the apps are on the table. Here comes the main course.
And here we are at Eat, Drink, Talk, the top, wonderful, the best podcast.
The most filling podcast in town,
it's
no doubt.
Delicious, all that stuff. It's all great. And Steve Coombs, my co-host, and I am Rick Redding, and we do this every week on the Louisville.am network. It's a lot of fun because we get to try a lot of stuff, don't we, Steve?
Sometimes too much stuff.
Too much stuff. That's one of my favorite songs. All right, before we get into the show, we got a lot to talk about today, but I want to thank our sponsors.
Harvest Restaurant is definitely one of our favorite sponsors. It's at 624 East Market in Nulu, where the menu, 80% of all the ingredients on that menu are sourced from 100 miles around Louisville. That's extremely difficult to do, but that's the dedication they have to being local. And you want to visit there for dinner Tuesday through Saturday, 5 to 10 p.m., brunch Friday through Sunday, 10 a.m. to 2:30 p.m., and you definitely want to make a reservation. Call 384-9090 for Harvest.
I'll speak from experience now, Steve. Later in the show, I'm going to talk about going out to eat at the Eagle, and that was my second choice because I wanted to go patronize our sponsor, and it was a long wait on Saturday.
Awesome. Good problem to have.
So I said, I'll try it again when it's less crowded. And another little Harvest tidbit, my interview this week with Dave Danielson at Churchill Downs, mm-hmm. I asked him what some of his favorite spots to go in town were. Number one on the list. How about that?
That's an endorsement. If I've heard one this week, that's great.
There you go. So we are also sponsored by our friends at the Eye Care Institute, where they take care of any eye care need you have, whether it's LASIK, whether it's a regular exam, whether you need glasses or contacts. The number down there is 502-589-1500. We really appreciate their sponsorship of this show.
Indeed, we do.
So, the big news in terms of openings this week, we got around, at least I got around to go to the Eagle.
I know. It's 8 blocks from me. I just need to walk there. But I had 3 other places to go this week.
Yeah, Food and Beer Hall is what it is. They had a good crowd on Saturday night.
Is that when you went
Friday?
Saturday?
No, it's Friday night.
Yeah?
It's Friday night. Of course, we don't plan well at my house. So,
Meaning what?
Meaning we got there and there was like a wait for a table, but we were able to go sit at the bar.
Was there a lot of people outside at the fire pits? I'm so glad they kept that part of it.
It was a little cool, but there were small groups gathered around the fire pits outside. So I think it's going to be a cool addition to the Bardstown Road scene. I really like the place.
Beer and fried chicken. It's hard to mess up with that.
I thought of this. Paul was making fun of me because I thought of this song. There's this old country song called Memphis Women and Fried Chicken. You have to look that
again.
Google that
another
one out, right?
Another good combination.
Yeah, Memphis women and fried chicken. That's the way that song goes, and it's pretty. It's just cool. I can recommend that place. I'll talk about the food later.
And speaking of another opening, Chow Bistro and Bar opened in the old Baxter Station stop on 1201 Payne Street. I've seen some photos online. Back Business First was the only one to put any up so far, and it looks gorgeous.
Yeah, I have heard that the interior is great. A guy I know went there. In fact, our sponsor at Eye Care Institute, Mark Prussian, told me that the place looks beautiful inside. But they didn't have that much of a crowd the other night.
Oh, he went on Saturday night,
yeah.
Right? Well, you know that I'm kind of putting some of that on Chow. Now, maybe they want to open up slowly and get their legs. And if that's the case, I think that's a fantastic idea. But if they were wanting for more, they've got to do stuff like put menus on your website, menus on your Facebook page, and pictures of everything. And
marketing.
You know, you've got to make it easy for the press to grab that information and go in these days where we all have no staffs to work with. But
especially if you're sort of off the beaten path like they are. I mean, it's not like you're going to just pass by that accidentally and say, hey, let's go in there.
And you know, some so far, little-known personalities are behind it. Helen Impelzeri is the chef. I've never heard of her. Bridget Pizzonia is the owner. Never heard of her. Now, Ashley Towning is the bar manager. I know her. She's really cool. But and Ashley was doing a great job, you know, talking about it opening, but then stopped. So that makes me think that maybe they want to open slowly. Just to kind of get their legs under them.
Okay.
It is gorgeous, though. You got to go see the pictures.
Yeah.
Or just go to the restaurant, for heaven's sakes.
I remember clearly, I used to go to Bachelor Station all the time, and it was sort of disjointed, I guess, in there. So, okay.
Putting it nicely.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so the other big thing going on around town has to do with booze. New distillery up in Simpsonville, near Simpsonville. Jeptha Creed.
Kind of in that netherland between Simpson and Shelbyville, right?
Right, but they have the view from the highway if you're on 64 heading out.
Big, beautiful building. Jeptha Creed Distillery is opening officially, was it Friday or today? I think it's maybe today, which is Monday.
Okay.
So it's a gorgeous facility. I've seen some photos and such. The only bad thing is they don't have any of their own bourbon yet.
Man.
Now, if that's the best, you just got to wait. I don't know how long they'll age their first run, but apparently there's some dollars behind that operation to be able to just start out like that. So probably get some White Dog, moonshine, things like that.
Have to go out there and see that one and maybe wait on the White Dog. I don't know.
Well, the big one that's opening this week, Wednesday, is actually to the press, is the Angel's Envy Distillery, which is right across the street from Against the Grain on Main Street. That will be a big darn deal. They've got plenty of bourbon that they have sourced or contract distilled at many other distilleries, and other distilleries, for some time. So when you go there, you will get a taste, but we probably won't taste Angel's Envy made in Louisville in that distillery for another 5 or 6 years, I think is how long they age their whiskeys.
Well, it's kind of cool that it's in that prominent location, and those of us, you know, I drive by there all the time, and you just see the progress. I remember the day they took the big vats, I guess, in, and you know, it's got a window so you can look inside
right
from the street, and you know, it's just kind of a cool addition to Main Street.
Yeah, you got that Bacardi money behind you. You can do a lot of stuff. At your own pace. But, man, that thing's been a work in progress for at least 6 years now.
So how's that going to work, Steve? I guess they're going to have tours open to the public, all that?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I believe the official opening date for the distillery is the 19th, which is, would that be Saturday, I guess?
I think so.
So, yeah, that'll be a big deal. Go down and see that because that will be a significant distillery. But with all these openings, meanwhile, restaurants are struggling.
I know. What do you think that is? I mean, it seems like it's...
Overcapacity. Total overcapacity. I mean, I keep talking to restaurateurs just at random. They're just saying that there's just not enough people who want this independent restaurant market, these opportunities to go around. You know, the people, the non-chain frequenter, they just say there's not enough of them, and yet they keep opening, and they will continue.
And there's still plenty of chains to compete. And,
So
you think we're going to see some closings?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know how the market can handle it. Yeah, because these people so many have held on so long with low revenue. I mean, you can only go so low. So they're stepping up. You know, the neat thing is there are a lot of special events that come up. Like at Equus, they had done for election night and the night after, it was the red, white, and blue dinner menu. So you watched election returns on Tuesday, and then you came back and talked about it the next night if you wanted to, and they had special menus, and apparently it was a big hit. So, yeah. I mean, that's nice to hear. And like Gospel Bird is doing, a week from today, they're doing a bourbon and bluegrass thing. You know, the menu is paired with Hickory Vought and Bernie Lovers doing their musical comedy routine about the history of bourbon.
Such a great thing. I've had Hickory on the Rusty Satellite Show just a few months ago.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's the one clever thing that's coming out of it are all these special events. But, you know, those are one-hit things. What these guys need is continual patronage, and it's hard to come by right now.
And it's, like you said earlier in the show, marketing. And those special events are a feature of marketing. And, you know, Louisville seems to be a special event town. I don't know that other towns aren't, but Louisville is, and you can draw a crowd if you have the right kind of promotion and special event
exposure. So, yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
We'll come if you have one. So there you go.
Well, let's talk about your guest a bit this week.
All right. Well, you know, I don't know about you, Steve, but I've never had, like, those big Thanksgiving dinners at home, necessarily. When I was growing up, my mom worked at Churchill Downs, and she worked for the then caterer, Harry M. Stevens. And what we did was she had us all up to her work. And so I spent maybe a dozen Thanksgivings at Churchill Downs. It was a lot of fun. Always enjoyed it. And I think now, as I think back on it, number one, I was a 15-year-old kid and wasn't too choosy about food, and I didn't really like it that well. But I think I would appreciate it now that Dave Danielson is in charge over there. And what a great guy he is.
He is a great guy and a great big guy. He's just, I mean, just he's almost like perfectly sized for that massive operation. You just can't imagine how much food is prepared in that place.
It really is. They're getting ready to have dinner for 7,000 on Thanksgiving Day over there. And it was funny. I've been everywhere at Churchill Downs, but I'd never been down to where Dave's office is. And boy, there's a lot of equipment, and he just went through all the things. You know, he is in charge of everything from the fine dining, great food at the luxury spots there, to
right
ordering the hot dogs.
I don't know how he does it.
It's really
I simply don't know how he does it, but he is he's such a friendly guy. And Churchill Downs in Louisville are lucky to have him. Now, he was part of the Levy Catering Company, and so they had him move down here. But I'm telling you, we're very fortunate to have him here because he's so involved in the restaurant community here.
Sure, and there's so much other stuff to talk about and write about on that. You know, they're redoing the entire grandstand food operation after this meet, and it's hard to imagine what a massive project that is.
I think they spent $18 million on his kitchens alone last year.
Wow.
$18 million.
Yeah. So
that's like 18 new independent restaurants. No kidding.
Yeah, it's really something, and it's something you got to go out to see. If you don't have plans for Thanksgiving, I'd say go out there. But, you know, it's quite a thing, and I was just very curious about the food operation over there because there's so much. As we said. So I went over and talked to Dave Danielson and found out what was going on behind the scenes at the Churchill Downs Kitchens.
Head coach of the Western Kentucky Hilltoppers, Jeff Rom.
Today I'm with Matt Jones,
Kevin Harned, Pat Forty.
I'm with Anoush Sheriott,
Crispin Wall,
United States Congressman John Yarmuth,
Sarah Brofancher, and Susie Eastman.
I have Kristen Boone,
one of St. Matthew's most favorite sons, Danny Flanagan.
It's Pat Day.
The list goes on and on. The most interesting people in the Ville are on the Rusty Satellite Show with Rick Redding. New episodes Thursdays on Louisville.am.
And I'm in a place I've never been before at Churchill Downs, down in the office of Dave Danielson. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Now, you are, we're getting ready for Thanksgiving here, but you told me that you're already getting ready for the Derby.
We are. You know, it's very funny. We prepare all year long for the Derby. It seems like you can't get far enough ahead. Even though we have so many other things going, we're a week out from Thanksgiving. We got about 7,000 people coming to Thanksgiving dinner. So we're in the midst of that, but we're also starting to do the initial tastings now for both Oaks and Derby.
Okay. And you get to come up with new items and new things for the Derby. Any sneak peek as to what we're looking at for next year?
Yeah, you know, I'm getting ready to do my seventh Derby, so we change the menu year over year. You know, we're always looking to kind of enhance the experience, take it to the next level. We're always looking for new ingredients, new purveyors. You know, I feel like when people come to Churchill Downs, not only for the Derby, but especially because I feel like we're on the world stage, we really try to showcase some local products, local ingredients, some things that are happening here that people may not have had a chance to taste anywhere outside of Louisville.
Okay. So what's new for next year?
What's new for next year?
I'm trying to get a scoop here.
So one of the things we do is we start off every day with what we call Southern Antipasti. So we have about 7 or 8 dishes that are all cold type of salads, some stuff that we deal with a lot of local farms. We're doing, we've got a strawberry caprese. We're doing a shrimp and grit risotto style. So, you know, what we try to do is take Southern-inspired dishes, put a unique twist on them. You know, the challenge for us is we do 22,000 people each day in our dining areas. So we've got about 125,000 people out here on Oaks, about 170,000 on Derby. Those 2 days in our dining areas, it's 22,000 people a day. So right now the process begins where we come up with the ideas, and then we really back into it with the farmers, see what they can produce, see what it's an enormous amount of volume for them to keep up with. That's one of the biggest challenges we have.
Well, that certainly is. And just since it's coming right up, Thanksgiving.
Yep.
When I was younger, I came to Thanksgiving at the track almost every year. Is there any twist, anything special? You just Thanksgiving, you think it would be traditional turkey
raising,
right?
Yeah, no. I mean, you know, I've got... I got 3,000 pounds of turkey coming in. I got about 1,700 pounds of ham. We're doing a nice sorghum glaze on the ham this year. But we try and keep it a little bit traditional. I think that especially, you know, when you get up this many people, we try and base it on that. But we do some unique flavor profiles. We've got, you know, butternut squash purees with a little bit of rosemary brown butter, some different type of things like that. Okay. So the food's recognizable, but, you know, I feel like, you know, for Thanksgiving, for Oaks and Derby, when people come here, look, it's very easy to say, hey, we're feeding the masses, but we really want to deliver that kind of fine dining restaurant experience to people.
Yeah. Well, I speak from experience. It's really great. Now, I want to ask you a little bit about yourself because, you know, you're here in Kentucky, but and have been, I think, since 2011, right?
Correct.
But trained in Paris. You've been all over the world.
Yeah. You know, I'm originally from Chicago. My background, it was really fine dining. I went to a very small French chef school, French culinary school. It was a 2,000-hour traditional apprenticeship. I spent 6 months interning with Four Seasons Group. They sent me to France. I spent a year working in France. And I came back, and, you know, I worked mostly fine dining, small restaurants. And at some point in my career, I ended up out in Las Vegas. It was really the first look I had at large volume. And... left there, moved to New York, went to work at Rockefeller Center, where I started doing some other large catering events. We were doing really, really high volume. I oversaw the production for all the restaurants in Rock Center. And, you know, then just I was kind of mesmerized of how we could do fine dining, how we could do the meld of doing large, large volume and keeping it at really high quality food. So that's kind of where my career turned.
Well, it's amazing. You were just showing me the one of the many kitchens out here. How many people are you responsible for?
Yeah. You know,
I guess it's everybody it's everybody. In terms of the food.
I mean, we have a huge team back of the house. You know, on any given day, we have between 100 and 120 cooks, stewarding, carvers. When we ramp up to night races or Thanksgiving, that number grows to several hundred. And then Derby Week, back of the house employees, you know, we're up in the 700-800 people. It's we have just under 3,000 food and beverage employees Derby Week. So it's an enormous undertaking.
Yeah, that sounds like it. Now, I'm always curious about this because everybody experiences Derby differently. But, you know, you're in charge of these thousands of people and all that. How do you spend Derby Day?
You know, it's funny because by Derby Day, it's, you know, the train has already left the station, as they will. You know, leading up to that week, it's 20-hour days. We get here 1 o'clock in the morning and work straight through. But by Derby Day, you know, everything's set. We've kind of worked out the kinks that we see during Oaks. And, you know, I spend a lot of time walking out, seeing guests, monitoring it, and looking at what's working, my mind is already thinking about the next one. But you can be sure when the race happens, I actually grab my staff and we go up on one of the roofs and I watch the race just like everybody else and screaming for our pick to come in.
And you're betting too, right?
I'm betting that everyone's going to have a good time.
Don't want to get you in trouble. All right, it's all fun on that, but I can imagine from you, you know, growing up in the industry and learning the industry, you never thought of like just doing a restaurant or something smaller. You seem to have gravitated toward these large volume enterprises.
Yeah, you know, I'd be lying if I said the thought doesn't cross my mind. You know, There's something very intimate. I do a lot of fundraisers. I do a lot of different things where I get to cook for people on that level. That is, you know, that's one of the trade-offs. It's one of the things I miss is not being in a 40, 50, 60-seat restaurant, being able to do that. There's a certain part of, you know, it takes me back to the beginning of my career, and it's a much more intimate experience. You know, it crosses my mind, but I always think, like, my God, after 6 months, you know, am I going to be bored out of my mind and going, what am I doing? So, you know, right now this is working well, and I really love it. I love Churchill. I love what we do, and I feel like we still have a lot more area to continue to move forward on.
Sure. Well, and living in Louisville, I guess you've lived in a lot bigger cities. I don't imagine you've lived in a smaller one, but you enjoy the city?
I love it. You know, we moved down here 6 years ago, my family, and it's really been an amazing experience for us. One, you know, it's a great city. I feel like it's big enough where there's anything you want, you can kind of find it here. But the dining scene's great. I feel like, you know, one of the things I really love about it is I get a lot closer proximity to some of the farmers, some of the growers. We have some amazing people in this city doing some crazy stuff, like Matt Jamie over at Bourbon Barrel. You know, I was just down at Red Hog watching these guys. And so there's some really cool guys and girls doing some amazing thing, and I get to spend a lot of time with them, and you know, you keep learning.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the last things I want to touch on, a lot of people focus on these big days. Thanksgiving is a big day here at Churchill Downs, and of course the Derby and all that, but you know, it's never like totally dark.
No, I mean, you know, it's, look, we're open all year round. We're always doing things, whether it's when we're live racing, we're doing a lot of catering, we do a lot of events. Obviously, you know, Churchill Downs is one of those places that it's on a lot of people's bucket lists. So we have people coming throughout the year who want to do some different stuff here. So, you know, I feel like we still need to provide that experience to every person every day when they walk through here. There's a certain magic about the place, and when people come in, you know, they're in awe. They walk around. There's a lot of history. They want to see it. So we work, myself and my team, you know, hard every day to make sure that we kind of exceed people's expectations.
All right. Well, last question I'm going to ask you about living in Louisville.
Yeah.
And the cuisine here, and Louisville is a food city. You have places you go when you're not working?
I do. I love what Patrick's doing down at Harvest. Like I say, I was just a Red Hog. Those guys are doing amazing stuff. You know, I go down to Milkwood, you know. But I tell you, too, I love traveling around a lot of the small barbecue places. Okay. So I'm always on the hunt for some of these little local places, you know, and just kind of seeing what some people are doing. I think that's the great thing here is we have such an unbelievable independent restaurant scene. And, you know, you can go into some of these small places and there's a lot of young guys and girls in there cooking their hearts out and trying to do some different stuff. So it seems like they're opening so fast, I can't get to all of them. But every chance I get, I'm out trying to, you know, see what's happening out there and see what people are doing.
Excuse me, garçon. I'll have another.
And we're back. And we're here to talk about our favorite things that we ate and drink.
The most popular segment on the Drink Talk podcast, I think.
Based at least on popular with us.
Yeah. We like to do it. It gives us an excuse to go out and get something.
Based on how much we like it. So this is going to be a little bit skewed, my favorite drinks of the week. There is a catering company in town run by a guy named Jared Schubert and his business partner, Lauren Van Cleve, called Lip Service, I believe. And they did a Prohibition-style dinner down at the Prohibition exhibit down at the Fraser Museum. And they did the cocktail part of it. And it was amazing how creative they are. And so, like, our first drink was an old-fashioned served in a medicine bottle to kind of reflect the medicinal whiskey permits. And they hid flasks of the next drink in the flower arrangements in front of it. And it was just all very, you know, speakeasy style things. Or you got julep glasses with so much of a hydrangea, you know, arrangement over top. It was like you're hiding your whole julep thing. It was just so darn creative.
Well, that sounds very cool. I've been down to the the exhibit down there.
Yeah, it's cool. Carrie Nation is spooky, isn't she?
Yeah, it's quite a thing down there. I guess they still got the Julius Friedman art on the walls. Down
I don't
there?
Know. The place is huge. I would hope so. I like his stuff.
Yeah, it's really good. Well, that sounds a lot more fun than what I would say. My favorite drink was simply an American Pale Ale at the Eagle, which at the bar is set up. That I don't know how many beers they have, but at least a dozen or so on tap.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think they got a good operation there. I've heard a lot of good things about it. And
an American Pale Ale would cut through that fatty fried chicken.
There you go.
Which is good.
It did just that. I think I had two.
Well, so the food portion of that Prohibition dinner was done by Patrick Roney, the chef at Harvest. And that dude is, I know we've said it several times on this show, he's an amazing talent. And I wrote down pheasant under glass consomme was my favorite thing, but you just have to see it to understand what it was. But he did, if you know what a Glencairn glass is, that little tulip-shaped glass for sniffing whiskey, that's what he served as his consomme in, and it just, you know, bits of pheasant and vegetables and just this really intricate knife work that says, man, that's just first rate. I mean, that's what he does and is, and that's the guy at Harvest you want to go have feed you.
There you go. That sounds top notch. I'm sorry I missed that, but I do want to mention the food at the Eagle. If you go there, we got the specialty of the house, the fried chicken, and they serve it with this sort of a. It's honey, but it's got a little spice in it.
So probably a little cayenne. Something simple.
Something very very simple. It added a lot to the taste of the chicken, which is, you know, it's fried chicken, so it was pretty good. But the vegetables, the sides they serve. They're good for sharing. We had sweet potatoes and mac and cheese. You know, I don't think those are that healthy, but
no, sweet potatoes are.
Yeah, well, with all the marshmallows on top.
Well, just a little embellishment, it's better than marshmallows and chocolate, for heaven's sakes. Even though that tastes good too.
Yeah, that's all good. We got to do some things that aren't that great for us every once in a while because it's fun.
But at Harvest, everything's great for you, right?
That's right.
Because they prepare it on site, they can it, they get everything from almost everything. They stress 80% of our menu comes from, you know, this region within 100 miles.
I promise to plan better and get a reservation.
That's right. We need to go together.
There you go.
With our spouses. Well, my spouse and your lady friend.
That's
clear
right.
Clear that out before things get confusing.
She doesn't want anybody to think that any marrying things going on there. So, definitely.
You know, the thing, hopefully for these restaurants that are these independent restaurants whose, you know, counts are low these days, it does tend to wind up around the holidays. So remember to make your reservation at 384-9090 at Harvest.
There you go. That sounds great. Our other sponsor, Eye Care Institute, right down here on Story Avenue in Butchertown. It's great. Mark, the CEO there, is wonderful. I need to get my new contacts done very soon. And
holiday present, right?
Yeah, it just takes a phone call, and they're right there. They're very friendly down there.
That way, you can see your kids better at Christmas to make sure there's not a fake one stepping in. And pulling a trick on you. Thank you,
Eye Care. That's happened to you, I bet.
Hers only one. You've got three.
Who's that guy over there? Little child there.
So my guest this week was a guy named Jim Kokoris, and he is has been a longtime publicist for the Jim Beam Whiskey Company and kind of a special publicist for the Noe family. And that's Booker Noe, Fred Noe, all the names that you know associated with Beam and their bourbon these days. And he just published a book called The Big Man of Jim Beam, Booker Noe. And he got to spend about, he'll say it in the interview, but I think it was somewhere between 10 and 14 years with Booker.
Wow.
Being his representative to the media. Now, a lot of times when you say publicist, that means they've got somebody on the leash and they're controlling them. There was no leash for Booker Noe. He was big and bold and funny and cantankerous and had a lot of attitude, like his whiskey.
A lot of good stories, I'm sure.
A lot of great stories, and Jim touches on some of those, and certainly the book is great, too. I'm about a third of the way through it so far, and he hasn't gotten off his own leash yet. So, but I know that Booker could step on toes and pat you on the back at the same time. He was just a fantastic guy, and, you know, some people credit him for the rebirth of bourbon in you know, the United States. I think he deserves a big share. But what about Bill Samuels and Maker's Mark? He was pimping bourbon way back in the 70s.
Yeah.
And pimping it hard. And who is it? Elmer T. Lee that created Blanton's? That was the first single barrel in 1985. That's way before Booker's. So there's a lot of people that deserve credit. But read the book and listen to Jim Kokoris first on Eat, Drink, Talk.
All right. That sounds great. It's a great interview, and that wraps up our show. We'll be back next week with another episode of Eat, Drink, Talk.
Hey, I'm Dan Vonderhyde.
I'm Stephanie White.
We host a weekly podcast called
40-ish.
It's a show about life at middle age.
I'm not 40 yet.
Well, you're getting there eventually.
I guess.
So each week we talk about something that applies to the life of a middle-aged person. We drop a little bit of wisdom in every episode, and we go out and talk to people about their experiences.
And we laugh.
And we laugh a lot. Comes out every Tuesday. Make sure you download.
Tune in.
My guest this week is Jim Kokoris, publicist for Jim Beam and current publicist for the No family of the Jim Beam historic, wonderful bourbon brand. And most importantly, for this particular event, the author of The Big Man of Jim Beam, The Story of Booker No. Jim, welcome to Eat, Drink, Talk.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me. Eager to talk and maybe drink some bourbon.
I know. I mean, in our careers, that just kind of happens, doesn't it? Especially if you come to Kentucky.
Absolutely. Right. Kentucky and bourbon go hand in hand.
Absolutely. So you were telling me that you began working with Booker in 1993.
I did. I was working for a large public relations agency at the time, and Jim Beam Brands at the time, as it was known, was a large account. I was assigned to it, and I was assigned to travel with Booker as his publicist and spoke, arranged events for him. And as fate would have it, the person who would also do these bourbon tastings with them actually was starting a family. She was got pregnant. So they asked me to fill in after 6 months. They said, why don't you give the setup for Booker, introduce him, do some bourbon history, and the rest is history. Because I just ended up, those 6 weeks I was supposed to do it for, I ended up being over 10 years traveling around the country as we conducted bourbon tastings for the small batch bourbon collections such as Knob Creek, Basil Hayden, Baker's, and Booker's Bourbon, which Booker introduced. So we'd talk about bourbon history. Booker would lead him through a tasting. I would then deal with all the reporters and beg them not to write some of the things.
So you kept him on the leash?
No, I did not. That's the reason I lasted. There was no leash with Booker. It was after the fact. It was begging reporters not to write what he just said. And if you do this, I'll send you a case of Booker's or a case of Knob Creek. Just please, if you write that, I will get fired. Because he was one of a kind, spoke his mind, very opinionated, at the same time, very, very authentic.
So that's kind of a mixed blessing in a job like that. You have a character who you don't have to gin up a story for. He's excited about his craft, and he's ready to go.
Yeah, you know, it's maybe it's a cliche, but he was an American original. I mean, he was larger than life, both figuratively and literally, 6'3", 350 pounds, got a voice like this. Said what he wanted to say, ate what he wanted to say, drank what he wanted to say, drink. So a real character, kept me busy.
Was he intimidating, or was he just hard to kind of control?
if you weren't a little intimidated by Booker, you probably had too much Booker in you, or too many glasses in you, because he was not a guy to, don't cross his path. Charming, wonderful, big-hearted, but someone you just, had to respect. It was his way or the highway.
And talk about his passion for whiskey making. I mean, he got into the business reluctantly, just kind of dragging his heels. He didn't really want to be in the family business, but once he got in, he caught fire.
Yeah, just kind of fell into it. His mom had to pull some strings to get him a job. He was given a job out at the main bean plant out in Claremont, but at more of a remote outpost in Boston, Kentucky, a smaller distillery at the time. They kind of just sent him out there, see what would happen. He took to it. The bourbon was in his, going in his veins. So he was really took to it.
Literally and symbolically. Yes, he'd like to drink.
He was known to partake. So, and it was at that smaller distillery, which still had very high productivity, but at the same time, or production, it was a little bit more in a place where he could experiment. So he kind of taught himself in a lot of ways to become a distiller. He had some help from his cousin Carl Beam, who was the master distiller at the plant at the time. But Booker was really an innovative, or he was very curious. He liked trying different processes and trying different ingredients to make bourbon.
Now, this small town boy who kind of liked to do his own thing. He went to UK to play football, quit. He went on the road, you know, kind of a little Jack Kerouac trip for a little bit, yeah. And came back. Was not really following where his parents wanted him to go to. Yeah. But even the, as you say in the book, the big man was light on his feet, was a great dancer. Did the focus and the intensity of bourbon making or whiskey making just that give him his purpose?
Absolutely. You know, he was kind of, I mean, like a lot of people at that age, 20, 21, 22 years old, he was searching for a direction in life, and it was really his mother who made this fateful call over to the distillery to T.J. Beam, who was Jim Beam's son, and said, you know, you got to hire this boy. He was working in a lumber yard out in Springfield, and he took to it right away. And he had some background. His grandfather, Jim Beam, took him to the plant. He grew up there hunting and fishing. He knew some of the basics. Was he? Did he know all about distilling? Absolutely not. But he had some background. He was a Beam. His mother's last name was Beam. So somebody he had that background to build on. But as I said, once he got to the plant out in Boston, which is now the Booker No plant, he learned from his cousin Carl, but also taught himself a lot.
Now, was he the type of guy that, once he was latched onto something, was he a workaholic? Was he super intense in that regard?
Yeah. Don't know about a workaholic, but certainly very intense and really wanted to. He was a perfectionist. He's very big into yield, trying to get, you know, as much whiskey out of a bushel of corn as possible. Very into efficiency. He had that plant so jerry-rigged with weird pipes and machines. And they said that when he finally passed away, and they went over there to the Boston, but they didn't know what the hell he had built up there. He was constantly trying different ways to make more bourbon and better bourbon. And so he was really, really...
Did he drive his people hard to do the same?
Yeah, he did. I mean, he still was a great boss. And they had incredible loyalty to him. He had this, you know, tight-knit group of guys out there. I always thought that Boston Club, they should make a movie of what was going on out there. It was about 30, 40 guys. I mean, most of them were, half of them were high school friends of Booker's that he personally picked. He didn't have no bourbon distillery experience whatsoever. So I always thought it was kind of an Animal House slash strikes going on out there. But he expected a certain loyalty and a certain effort out of them. And they gave it back to him.
Now, Fred was a bit like his dad, only worse in terms of going wayward and having a little fun before he got serious about whiskey making.
You know, Fred, you know, took his time to find his path, too. And he, you know, definitely...
And we should also note that you wrote a book. You and Fred co-wrote a book. Yeah. That's right. And what was the name of it for listeners?
Beam Straight Up.
Beam Straight Up.
They came out in, I think, 2012. Same publisher, Wiley.
Good book. I did read it.
Oh, thank you. And I'll tell Fred that. Fred is... you know, he's paid his dues. 20 years on the working at the plant. Nothing was handed to him. Started as a night shift bottling line supervisor.
And Booker insisted on putting him on the bottom rung to train him, right?
He earned his stripes, learned the business from the ground up. Mellower in a lot of ways than Booker, the older he got. And, you know Fred now is the master distiller, too. So grew into the role and probably in a lot of ways matured quicker than Booker did, I think, in terms of his lifestyle and his consumption habits. Fred is a very moderate drinker, and people always ask me, so I thought I'd just offer that. He treats, like most beings do, treats the whiskey with great respect. And
how was the interaction between those two? Once Fred signed on. And he and Booker saw eye to eye. Was it a really good business relationship?
There were like a lot of father and sons, and this is in the book, so I'm not speaking out of school here. A lot of father son relationships. It had strained moments. Mm-hmm. Booker was a very stern taskmaster and had very high expectations for Fred, and some of those expectations weren't initially met. And so I don't think their relationship was ever in a really bad place. But there were more tense, stressful moments to it than people might think, too.
I bet.
I think at the end, Booker was extremely proud of what Fred was accomplishing. And I think that led to Fred Booker stepping down when he did as the primary spokesperson for the company.
And very confident that Fred was doing a good job.
Yeah, and Fred's right? A natural. I mean, he just took to this like a duck to water.
So I was reading today in your book the part about the release of Booker's. And how the company kind of poo-pooed it and really didn't see the promise in it. But somebody was smart enough to say, you know what? If you're going to really make this unique, we're going to charge some money for it, $39.99, which right. We can still find that price around here in Louisville, believe it or not. Wow. What was Costco.
Oh, okay.
Believe it or not, I saw it today.
I remember. Okay.
But how was that? I mean, I know you weren't there with the company at the time and helping them, but how difficult was that for him to push that through and say, this is going to be a super product and I know what's going to happen?
You know, it wasn't that hard. He'd been making Booker's Bourbon in the Boston plant for years, giving away to family and friends. That's kind of legend, but it's just true. He would just give it away during the holidays. And it was an executive from Chicago where Jim Beam's base came down, and they were looking for a special gift to give to their retailers and distributors and salesperson around the holidays. And he said, what do you got? What do you have? And Booker said, well, I got this. And the executive took a drink of it, and I would say he tasted the future. So they brought it along very... Booker didn't even have to sell the idea again. He had to sell certain parts of it. The higher proof, the handwritten label that Booker made at his kitchen table, the very, at the time, cheap bottle of packaging. It's not cheap now, but by the time he got a lot of old wine
bottles, right?
Yeah, uh-huh. But they had no budget. And so they did this on a shoestring. They had no marketing support. It went out, I think, in 87 to, I think, a couple thousand bottles went out to key retailers as gifts.
Uh-huh.
And the next year, they sold it, a few more. But for 2-3 years, there's always this myth that Booker's exploded and it changed the industry. It did not. It was a very gradual selling, product that finally became established maybe 1990, 1991. But they also insisted on charging a premium price for it because it deserved it. It was, you know, it was just made with more tender love and carried more attention, better placement in the rack house, longer age, and a higher proof. So it required, it warranted the price that at the time that it was asking. And then Knapp Creek, Basil Hayden's, and Baker's came out. Main director Booker's good friend and cousin Baker Beam in, I think, 92.
Mm-hmm.
Small batch bourbon. And that really is, you know, we're experiencing this amazing bourbon, as you all know and your listeners know too right now. It's an amazing, you know, period for bourbon. But you can really trace it. The success back to the early 90s. And really, this has been coming for a long time. This is not something that just happened a few years ago. And it was small-batch bourbon and Booker's bourbon that helps ignite the flame.
And so, last question. How significant was Booker No to this bourbon revitalization?
You know, I don't think anyone would disagree with me. I'm going to sound like a homer here, talking about my guy, but... he was really, most people will say it started with him and his vision and his products and his effort. You know, Booker's was the first super premium bourbon to catch fire. The small batch bourbon was the first collection of bourbons to warrant the attention of fine whiskey connoisseurs. Mm-hmm. They saw what was happening with single malt scotches, and they said, well, why not us? If they're going to drink and pay for that, why can't they? We up our game, and maybe we'll offer something that they will consider as well. So, and it all started in the early 90s, and it all started with small batch bourbon. And I don't think even Jim Beam's competitors will deny that fact.
Talk about the showman part of it.
Well, in the 90s, after the small batch came out, the other companies were coming out with stuff too at that uh-huh. time, including some Booker's and relatives of different distilleries. They realized they had a secret weapon. They had Booker No as a spokesperson. No one else had Booker. And he was really the first quote-unquote celebrity master distiller. Now these master distillers are like rock stars. But back
right.
then, they were just working guys who kind of did everything. And Booker William even told me, I don't know, one day they just started calling me master distiller. But it was no big deal back in the 60s. But he was the first one. We put him on the road. And that's when I met him. That's when we started traveling together. Crowds were small at first, 12, 15, 20 people in hotels, smaller.
Right.
By the end of his tenure there, he was, you know, I wouldn't say selling out. We didn't charge, but 300, 400, 500 people would come, wait in line for 45 minutes. Quite a bit of media attention. You know, television, radio, and newspaper. Every reporter loved him. He was such an original, such an authentic, and such a sincere guy.
Jim Kokoris, thanks for being our guest.
Oh,
and by the way, where's the best place to find the book? Amazon?
You can buy Amazon. I think bookstores, too. And I would be remiss if the holidays fast approaching. A copy of the book in a bottle in Knob Creek. Wow, what a stocking stuffer. So.
And the book is, again, The Big Man of Jim Beam, The Story of Booker No. Get it. Thanks again, Jim.
Thank you.
If you just can't get enough, catch up on the news of the city's restaurant scene every single day by visiting www.eatdrinktalk.net. Steve and Rick share all the latest local scoop from Louisville's restaurants and bars. You can also find old episodes of the show and connect with the guys on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Eat well, my friends. Another episode next week.